Actually, Harry, I think I'd better go after him. I don't think he knows what he's doing. And if he gets caught, the whole thing... Level 1, Minister of Magic and Support Staff.
The golden grills slid apart again and Hermione gasped. 4 people stood before them, 2 of them deep in conversation, a long-haired wizard wearing magnificent robes of black and gold, and a squat, toad-like witch wearing a velvet bow in her short hair and clutching a clipboard to her chest. Chapter 13. The Muggle-Born Registration Commission.
"Ah, Mafalda,"
said Umbridge, looking at Hermione.
"Travers sent you, did he?"
"Yes,"
squeaked Hermione.
"Good. You'll do perfectly well."
Umbridge spoke to the wizard in black and gold.
"That's that problem solved, Minister. If Mafalda can be spared for record-keeping, we should be able to start straight away."
She consulted her clipboard.
10 people today, and one of them the wife of a ministry employee. Tut-tut. Even here, in the heart of the ministry."
She stepped into the lift beside Hermione, as did the 2 wizards who had been listening to Umbridge's conversation with the minister.
"We'll go straight down, Mafalda. You'll find everything you need in the courtroom. Good morning, Albert. Aren't you getting out?"
Yes, of course,
said Harry in Runcorn's deep voice. Harry stepped out of the lift. The golden grills clanged shut behind him. Glancing over his shoulder, Harry saw Hermione's anxious face sinking back out of sight, a tall wizard on either side of her, Umbridge's velvet hair bow level with her shoulder.
"What brings you up here, Runcorn?"
asked the new Minister of Magic. His long black hair and beard were streaked with silver, and a great overhanging forehead shadowed his glinting eyes, putting Harry in mind of a crab looking out from beneath a rock.
"Needed a quick word with..."
Harry hesitated for a fraction of a second.
"Arthur Weasley. Someone said he was up on level 1.
"Ah," said Pious Thickness. "Has he been caught having contact with an undesirable?"
"No," said Harry, his throat dry. "No, nothing like that."
"Ah, well, it's only a matter of time," said Thickness. "If you ask me, the blood traitors are as bad as the mudbloods. Good day, Runcorn."
"Good day, Minister."
Harry watched Thickness march away along the thickly carpeted corridor. The moment the minister had passed out of sight, Harry tugged the invisibility cloak out from under his heavy black cloak, threw it over himself, and set off along the corridor in the opposite direction. Runcorn was so tall that Harry was forced to stoop to make sure his big feet were hidden. Panic pulsed in the pit of his stomach. As he passed gleaming wooden door after gleaming wooden door, each bearing a small plaque with the owner's name and occupation upon it, the might of the ministry, its complexity, its impenetrability, seemed to force itself upon him, so that the plan he had been carefully concocting with Ron and Hermione over the past 4 weeks seemed laughably childish. They had concentrated all their efforts on getting inside without being detected. They had not given a moment's thought to what they would do if they were forced to separate. Now Hermione was stuck in court proceedings, which would undoubtedly last hours. Ron was struggling to do magic that Harry was sure was beyond him. A woman's liberty, possibly depending on the outcome. And he, Harry, was wandering around on the top floor when he knew perfectly well that his quarry had just gone down in the lift. He stopped walking, leaned against a wall, and tried to decide what to do. The silence pressed upon him. There was no bustling or talk or swift footsteps here. The purple-carpeted corridors were as hushed as though the Muffliato charm had been cast over the place.
"Her office must be up here,"
Harry thought. It seemed most unlikely that Umbridge would keep her jewelry in her office, but on the other hand, it seemed foolish not to search it to make sure. He therefore set off along the corridor again, passing nobody but a frowning wizard who was murmuring instructions to a quill that floated in front of him, scribbling on a trail of parchment. Now paying attention to the names on the doors, Harry turned a corner. Halfway along the next corridor, he emerged into a wide open space where a dozen witches and wizards sat in rows at small desks, not unlike school desks, though much more highly polished and free from graffiti. Harry paused to watch them, for the effect was quite mesmerizing. They were all waving and twiddling their wands in unison, and squares of colored paper were flying in every direction like little pink kites. After a few seconds, Harry realized that there was a rhythm to the proceedings, that the papers all formed the same pattern. And after a few more seconds, he realized that what he was watching was the creation of pamphlets, that the paper squares were pages which, when assembled, folded, and magicked into place, fell into neat stacks beside each witch or wizard. Harry crept closer, although the workers were so intent on what they were doing that he doubted they would notice a carpet-muffled footstep, and he slid a completed pamphlet from the pile beside a young witch. He examined it beneath the invisibility cloak. Its pink cover was emblazoned with a golden title, Mudbloods, and the dangers they pose to a peaceful, pure-blood society. Beneath the title was a picture of a red rose with a simpering face in the middle of its petals, being strangled by a green weed with fangs and a scowl. There was no author's name upon the pamphlet, but again, the scars on the back of his right hand seemed to tingle as he examined it. Then the young witch beside him confirmed his suspicion as she said, still waving and twirling her wand,
"Will the old hag be interrogating mudbloods all day? Does anyone know?"
"Careful," said the wizard beside her, glancing around nervously. One of his pages slipped and fell to the floor.
"What? Has she got magic ears as well as an eye now?"
The witch glanced toward the shining mahogany door facing the space full of pamphlet makers. Harry looked too, and rage reared in him like a snake. Where there might have been a peephole on a muggle front door, a large round eye with a bright blue iris had been set into the wood. An eye that was shockingly familiar to anybody who had known Alastor Moody. For a split second, Harry forgot where he was and what he was doing there. He even forgot that he was invisible. He strode straight over to the door to examine the eye. It was not moving. It gazed blindly upward, frozen. The plaque beneath it read, "Dolores Umbridge, Senior Undersecretary to the Minister." Below that, a slightly shinier new plaque read, "Head of the Muggleborn Registration Commission." Harry looked back at the dozen pamphlet makers. Though they were intent upon their work, he could hardly suppose that they would not notice if the door of an empty office opened in front of them. He therefore withdrew from an inner pocket an odd object with little waving legs and a rubber-bulbed horn for a body. Crouching down beneath the cloak, he placed the decoy detonator on the ground. It scuttled away at once through the legs of the witches and wizards in front of him. A few moments later, during which Harry waited with his hand upon the doorknob, there came a loud bang, and a great deal of acrid black smoke billowed from a corner. The young witch in the front row shrieked. Pink pages flew everywhere, and she and her fellows jumped up, looking around for the source of the commotion. Harry turned the doorknob, stepped into Umbridge's office, and closed the door behind him. He felt he had stepped back in time. The room was exactly like Umbridge's office at Hogwarts. Lace draperies, doilies, and dried flowers covered every available surface. The walls bore the same ornamental plates, each featuring a highly colored, beribboned kitten, gamboling and frisking with sickening cuteness. The desk was covered with a flouncy flowered cloth. Behind Mad-Eye's eye, a telescopic attachment enabled Umbridge to spy on the workers on the other side of the door. Harry took a look through it and saw that they were all still gathered around the decoy detonator. He wrenched the telescope out of the door, leaving a hole behind, pulled the magical eyeball out of it, and placed it in his pocket. Then he turned to face the room again, raised his wand, and murmured, "Hasio, lock it." Nothing happened, but he had not expected it to. No doubt Umbridge knew all about protective charms and spells. He therefore hurried behind her desk and began pulling open the drawers. He saw quills and notebooks and spellotape, enchanted paper clips that coiled snake-like from their drawer and had to be beaten back, a fussy little lace box full of spare hair bows and clips, but no sign of a locket. There was a filing cabinet behind the desk. Harry set to searching it. Like Filch's filing cabinets at Hogwarts, it was full of folders, each labeled with a name. It was not until Harry reached the bottommost drawer that he saw something to distract him from his search. Mr. Weasley's file. He pulled it out and opened it. Arthur Weasley. Blood status, pure blood, but with unacceptable pro-Muggle leanings. Known member of the Order of the Phoenix. Family, wife, pure blood. 7 children, 2 youngest at Hogwarts. N.B., youngest son currently at home, seriously ill. Ministry inspectors have confirmed. Security status, tracked. All movements are being monitored. Strong likelihood undesirable number 1 will contact. Has stayed with Weasley family previously.
Undesirable number 1?
Harry muttered under his breath as he replaced Mr. Weasley's folder and shut the drawer. He had an idea he knew who that was, and, sure enough, as he straightened up and glanced around the office for fresh hiding places, he saw a poster of himself on the wall with the words, Undesirable Number 1, emblazoned across his chest. A little pink note was stuck to it with a picture of a kitten in the corner. Harry moved across to read it and saw that Umbridge had written, To be punished. Angrier than ever, he proceeded to grope in the bottoms of the vases and baskets of dried flowers, but was not at all surprised that the locket was not there. He gave the office one last sweeping look, and his heart skipped a beat. Dumbledore was staring at him from a small rectangular mirror propped up on a bookcase beside the desk. Harry crossed the room at a run and snatched it up, but realized the moment he touched it that it was not a mirror at all. Dumbledore was smiling wistfully out of the front cover of a glossy book. Harry had not immediately noticed the curly green writing across his hat, The Life and Lies of Albus Dumbledore, nor the slightly smaller writing across his chest, by Rita Skeeter, best-selling author of Armando Dippet, Master or Moron. Harry opened the book at random and saw a full-page photograph of 2 teenage boys, both laughing immoderately with their arms around each other's shoulders. Dumbledore, now with elbow-length hair, had grown a tiny wispy beard that recalled the one on Crumb's chin that had so annoyed Ron. The boy who roared in silent amusement beside Dumbledore had a gleeful, wild look about him. His golden hair fell in curls to his shoulders. Harry wondered whether it was a young Doge, but before he could check the caption, the door of the office opened. If Thickness had not been looking over his shoulder as he entered, Harry would not have had time to pull the invisibility cloak over himself. As it was, he thought Thickness might have caught a glimpse of movement, because for a moment or two he remained quite still, staring curiously at the place where Harry had just vanished. Perhaps deciding that all he had seen was Dumbledore scratching his nose on the front of the book, for Harry had hastily replaced it upon the shelf, Thickness finally walked to the desk and pointed his wand at the quill standing ready in the inkpot. It sprang out and began scribbling a note to Umbridge. Very slowly, hardly daring to breathe, Harry backed out of the office into the open area beyond. The pamphlet makers were still clustered around the remains of the decoy detonator, which continued to hoot feebly as it smoked. Harry hurried off up the corridor, as the young witch said,
I bet it sneaked up here from experimental charms. They're so careless. Remember that poisonous duck?
Speeding back toward the lifts, Harry reviewed his options. It had never been likely that the locket was here at the Ministry, and there was no hope of bewitching its whereabouts out of Umbridge while she was sitting in a crowded court. Their priority now had to be to leave the Ministry before they were exposed and try again another day. The first thing to do was to find Ron, and then they could work out a way of extracting Hermione from the courtroom. The lift was empty when it arrived. Harry jumped in and pulled off the invisibility cloak as it started its descent. To his enormous relief, when it rattled to a halt at level 2, a soaking wet and wild-eyed Ron got in.
"Morning,"
he stammered to Harry as the lift set off again.
"Ron, it's me, Harry."
"Harry, blimey, I forgot what you looked like. Why isn't Hermione with you?"
"She had to go down to the courtrooms with Umbridge. She couldn't refuse, and..."
But before Harry could finish, the lift had stopped again. The doors opened, and Mr. Weasley walked inside, talking to an elderly witch whose blonde hair was teased so high it resembled an anthill.
I quite understand what you're saying, Wakanda, but I'm afraid I cannot be party to...
Mr. Weasley broke off. He had noticed Harry. It was very strange to have Mr. Weasley glare at him with that much dislike. The lift doors closed, and the four of them trundled downward once more.
"Oh. Hello, Reg," said Mr. Weasley, looking around at the sound of steady dripping from Ron's robes. "Isn't your wife in for questioning today? What's happened to you? Why are you so wet?"
"Yaxley's office is raining," said Ron.
He addressed Mr. Weasley's shoulder, and Harry felt sure he was scared that his father might recognize him if they looked directly into each other's eyes.
"I couldn't stop it, so they've sent me to get Bernie. Pillsworth, I think they said."
"Yes, a lot of offices have been raining lately," said Mr. Weasley. "Did you try Meteola Jinx Recanto? It worked for Bletchley."
"Meteola Jinx Recanto?" whispered Ron. "No, I didn't. Thanks, thanks, Arthur."
The lift doors opened. The old witch with the anthill hair left, and Ron darted past her out of sight. Harry made to follow him, but found his path blocked as Percy Weasley strode into the lift, his nose buried in some papers he was reading. Not until the doors had clanged shut again did Percy realize he was in a lift with his father. He glanced up, saw Mr. Weasley, turned radish red, and left the lift the moment the doors opened again. For the second time, Harry tried to get out, but this time found his way blocked by Mr. Weasley's arm.
"One moment, Runcorn."
The lift doors closed, and as they clanked down another floor, Mr. Weasley said,
"I hear you laid information about Dirk Criswell."
Harry had the impression that Mr. Weasley's anger was no less because of the brush with Percy. He decided his best chance was to act stupid.
"Sorry," he said.
"Don't pretend, Runcorn," said Mr. Weasley fiercely. "You tracked down the wizard who faked his family tree, didn't you?"
"I saw what if I did," said Harry.
"So Dirk Criswell is 10 times the wizard you are," said Mr. Weasley quietly, as the lift sank even lower. "And if he survives Azkaban, you'll have to answer to him, not to mention his wife, his sons, and his friends."
"Arthur," Harry interrupted, "you know you're being tracked, don't you?"
"Is that a threat, Runcorn?" said Mr. Weasley loudly.
"No," said Harry. "It's a fact. They're watching your every move."
The lift doors opened. They had reached the atrium. Mr. Weasley gave Harry a scathing look and swept from the lift. Harry stood there, shaken. He wished he was impersonating somebody other than Runcorn. The lift doors clanged shut. Harry pulled out the invisibility cloak and put it back on. He would try to extricate Hermione on his own while Ron was dealing with the reigning office. When the doors opened, he stepped out into a torch-lit stone passageway, quite different from the wood-paneled and carpeted corridors above. As the lift rattled away again, Harry shivered slightly, looking toward the distant black door that marked the entrance to the Department of Mysteries. He set off, his destination not the black door, but the doorway he remembered on the left-hand side, which opened onto the flight of stairs down to the court chambers. His mind grappled with possibilities as he crept down them. He still had a couple of decoy detonators, but perhaps it would be better to simply knock on the courtroom door, enter as Runcorn, and ask for a quick word with Mafalda. Of course, he did not know whether Runcorn was sufficiently important to get away with this, and even if he managed it, Hermione's non-reappearance might trigger a search before they were clear of the ministry. Lost in thought, he did not immediately register the unnatural chill that was creeping over him, as if he were descending into fog. It was becoming colder and colder with every step he took, a cold that reached right down into his throat and tore at his lungs. And then he felt that stealing sense of despair, of hopelessness, filling him, expanding inside him.
"Dementors," he thought.
And as he reached the foot of the stairs and turned to his right, he saw a dreadful scene. The dark passage outside the courtrooms was packed with tall, black-hooded figures, their faces completely hidden, their ragged breathing the only sound in the place. The petrified Muggleborns, brought in for questioning, sat huddled and shivering on hard wooden benches. Most of them were hiding their faces in their hands, perhaps in an instinctive attempt to shield themselves from the Dementors' greedy mouths. Some were accompanied by families, others sat alone. The Dementors were gliding up and down in front of them, and the cold and the hopelessness and the despair of the place laid themselves upon Harry like a curse. "Fight it," he told himself, but he knew that he could not conjure a Patronus here without revealing himself instantly. So he moved forward as silently as he could, and with every step he took, numbness seemed to steal over his brain. But he forced himself to think of Hermione and of Ron, who needed him. Moving through the towering black figures was terrifying. The eyeless faces hidden beneath their hoods turned as he passed, and he felt sure that they sensed him, sensed, perhaps, a human presence that still had some hope, some resilience. And then, abruptly and shockingly amid the frozen silence, one of the dungeon doors on the left of the corridor was flung open, and screams echoed out of it.
"No, no! I'm half-blood! I'm half-blood, I tell you! My father was a wizard! He was! Look him up, Archie Alderson! He's a well-known broomstick designer! Look him up, I tell you! Get your hands off me! Get your hands off!"
"This is your final warning," said Umbridge's soft voice, magically magnified so that it sounded clearly over the man's desperate screams. "If you struggle, you will be subjected to the Dementor's kiss." The man's screams subsided, but dry sobs echoed through the corridor.
"Take him away," said Umbridge.
Two Dementors appeared in the doorway of the courtroom, their rotting, scabbed hands clutching the upper arms of a wizard who appeared to be fainting. They glided away down the corridor with him, and the darkness they trailed behind them swallowed him from sight.
"Next, Mary Catamole," called Umbridge.
A small woman stood up. She was trembling from head to foot. Her dark hair was smoothed back into a bun, and she wore long plain robes. Her face was completely bloodless. As she passed the Dementors, Harry saw her shudder. He did it instinctively without any sort of plan, because he hated the sight of her walking alone into the dungeon. As the door began to swing closed, he slipped into the courtroom behind her. It was not the same room in which he had once been interrogated for improper use of magic. This one was much smaller, though the ceiling was quite as high. It gave the claustrophobic sense of being stuck at the bottom of a deep well. There were more Dementors in here, casting their freezing aura over the place. They stood like faceless sentinels in the corners farthest from the high, raised platform. Here, behind a balustrade, sat Umbridge, with Yaxley on one side of her, and Hermione, quite as white-faced as Mrs. Cattermole, on the other. At the foot of the platform, a bright silver, long-haired cat prowled up and down, and Harry realized that it was there to protect the prosecutors from the despair that emanated from the Dementors. That was for the accused to feel, not the accusers.
"Sit down," said Umbridge in her soft, silky voice.
Mrs. Cattermole stumbled to the single seat in the middle of the floor beneath the raised platform. The moment she had sat down, chains clinked out of the arms of the chair and bound her there.
"You are Mary Elizabeth Cattermole?"
asked Umbridge. Mrs. Cattermole gave a single shaky nod.
"Married to Reginald Cattermole of the Magical Maintenance Department?"
Mrs. Cattermole burst into tears.
"I don't know where he is. He was supposed to meet me here."
Umbridge ignored her.
"Mother to Maisie, Ellie, and Alfred Cattermole?"
Mrs. Cattermole sobbed harder than ever.
"They're frightened. They think I might not come home."
"Spare us," spat Yaxley. "The brats of mudbloods do not stir our sympathies."
Mrs. Cattermole's sobs masked Harry's footsteps as he made his way carefully toward the steps that led up to the raised platform. The moment he had passed the place where the Patronus cat patrolled, he felt the change in temperature. It was warm and comfortable here. The Patronus, he was sure, was Umbridge's, and it glowed brightly because she was so happy here, in her element, upholding the twisted laws she had helped to write. Slowly and very carefully, he edged his way along the platform behind Umbridge, Yaxley, and Hermione, taking a seat behind the latter. He was worried about making Hermione jump. He thought of casting the Muffliato charm upon Umbridge and Yaxley, but even murmuring the word might cause Hermione alarm. Then Umbridge raised her voice to address Mrs. Cattermole, and Harry seized his chance.
"I'm behind you,"
he whispered into Hermione's ear. As he had expected, she jumped so violently she nearly overturned the bottle of ink with which she was supposed to be recording the interview. But both Umbridge and Yaxley were concentrating upon Mrs. Cattermole, and this went unnoticed.
"A wand was taken from you upon your arrival at the Ministry today, Mrs. Cattermole,"
Umbridge was saying.
8¾ inches, cherry, unicorn hair, core. Do you recognize that description?"
Mrs. Cattermole nodded, mopping her eyes on her sleeve.
"Could you please tell us from which witch or wizard you took that wand?"
Took?
Sobbed Mrs. Cattermole.
"I didn't take it from anybody. I bought it when I was 11 years old. It chose me."
She cried harder than ever. Umbridge laughed, a soft girlish laugh that made Harry want to attack her. She leaned forward over the barrier, the better to observe her victim, and something gold swung forward too and dangled over the void. The locket. Hermione had seen it. She let out a little squeak, but Umbridge and Yaxley, still intent upon their prey, were deaf to everything else.
"No,"
said Umbridge.
"No, I don't think so, Mrs. Cattermole. Wands only choose witches or wizards. You are not a witch. I have your responses to the questionnaire that was sent to you here. Mafalda, pass them to me."
Umbridge held out a small hand. She looked so toad-like at that moment that Harry was quite surprised not to see webs between the stubby fingers. Hermione's hands were shaking with shock. She fumbled in a pile of documents balanced on the chair beside her, finally withdrawing a sheaf of parchment with Mrs. Cattermole's name on it.
That's pretty, Dolores,"
she said, pointing at the pendant gleaming in the ruffled folds of Umbridge's blouse.
"What?"
snapped Umbridge, glancing down.
"Oh, yes. An old family heirloom,"
she said, patting the locket lying on her large bosom.
"The S stands for Selwyn. I am related to the Selwyns. Indeed, there are few pure-blood families to whom I am not related. A pity,"
she continued in a louder voice, flicking through Mrs. Cattermole's questionnaire,
"that the same cannot be said for you. Parents' professions. Greengrocers."
Yaxley laughed jeeringly. Below, the fluffy silver cat patrolled up and down, and the Dementors stood waiting in the corners. It was Umbridge's lie that brought the blood surging into Harry's brain and obliterated his sense of caution, that the locket she had taken as a bribe from a petty criminal was being used to bolster her own pure-blood credentials. He raised his wand, not even troubling to keep it concealed beneath the invisibility cloak, and said,
"Stupefy!"
There was a flash of red light. Umbridge crumpled, and her forehead hit the edge of the balustrade. Mrs. Cattermole's papers slid off her lap onto the floor, and, down below, the prowling silver cat vanished. Ice-cold air hit them like an oncoming wind. Yaxley, confused, looked around for the source of the trouble, and saw Harry's disembodied hand and wand pointing at him. He tried to draw his own wand, but too late.
"Stupefy!"
Yaxley slid to the ground to lie curled on the floor.
"Harry!"
"Hermione, if you think I was going to sit here and let her pretend..."
"Harry! Mrs. Cattermole!"
Harry whirled around, throwing off the invisibility cloak. Down below, the Dementors had moved out of their corners. They were gliding toward the woman chained to the chair. Whether because the Patronus had vanished, or because they sensed that their masters were no longer in control, they seemed to have abandoned restraint. Mrs. Cattermole let out a terrible scream of fear as a slimy, scabbed hand grasped her chin and forced her face back.
"Expecto Patronum!"
The silver stag soared from the tip of Harry's wand and leapt toward the Dementors, which fell back and melted into the dark shadows again. The stag's light, more powerful and more warming than the cat's protection, filled the whole dungeon as it cantered around and around the room.
"Get the Horcrux!"
Harry told Hermione. He ran back down the steps, stuffing the invisibility cloak back into his bag, and approached Mrs. Cattermole.
"You,"
she whispered, gazing into his face.
But Rache said you were the one who submitted my name for questioning.
Did I?
Muttered Harry, tugging at the chains binding her arms.
Well, I've had a change of heart. Defindo!
Nothing happened.
Hermione, how do I get rid of these chains?
Wait, I'm trying something up here.
Hermione, we're surrounded by Dementors.
I know that, Harry, but if she wakes up and the locket's gone, I need to duplicate it. Geminio! There, that should fool her.
Hermione came running downstairs.
Let's see. Relatio!
The chains clinked and withdrew into the arms of the chair. Mrs. Cattermole looked just as frightened as ever before.
I don't understand,
she whispered.
You're going to leave here with us,
said Harry, pulling her to her feet.
Go home, grab your children, and get out. Get out of the country if you've got to. Disguise yourselves and run. You've seen how it is. You won't get anything like a fair hearing here.
Harry,
said Hermione,
how are we going to get out of here with all those Dementors outside the door?
Patronuses,
said Harry, pointing his wand at his own. The stag slowed and walked, still gleaming brightly, toward the door.
As many as we can muster. Do yours, Hermione.
Expecto Patronum,
said Hermione. Nothing happened.
It's the only spell she ever has trouble with, Harry told a completely bemused Mrs. Cattermole. Bit unfortunate, really. Come on, Hermione.
Expecto Patronum!
A silver otter burst from the end of Hermione's wand and swam gracefully through the air to join the stag.
Come on,
said Harry, and he led Hermione and Mrs. Cattermole to the door. When the Patronuses glided out of the dungeon, there were cries of shock from the people waiting outside. Harry looked around. The Dementors were falling back on both sides of them, melding into the darkness, scattering before the silver creatures.
It's been decided that you should all go home and go into hiding with your families,
Harry told the waiting Muggleborns, who were dazzled by the light of the Patronuses and still cowering slightly.
Go abroad if you can. Just get well away from the Ministry. That's the, new official position. Now, if you'll just follow the Patronuses, you'll be able to leave from the atrium.
They managed to get up the stone steps without being intercepted, but as they approached the lifts, Harry started to have misgivings. If they emerged into the atrium with a silver stag, an otter soaring alongside it, and 20 or so people, half of them accused Muggleborns, he could not help feeling that they would attract unwanted attention. He had just reached this unwelcome conclusion when the lift clanged to a halt in front of them.
Reg!
Screamed Mrs. Cattermole, and she threw herself into Run's arms.
Runcorn let me out. He attacked Umbridge and Yaxley, and he's told all of us to leave the country. I think we'd better do it, Reg. I really do. Let's hurry home and fetch the children and... Why are you so wet?
Water,
muttered Ron, disengaging himself.
Harry, they know there are intruders inside the Ministry. Something about a hole in Umbridge's office door. I reckon we've got 5 minutes, if that.
Hermione's Patronus vanished with a pop as she turned a horror-struck face to Harry.
Harry, if we're trapped here...
We won't be if we move fast,
said Harry. He addressed the silent group behind them, who were all gawping at him.
Who's got wands?
About half of them raised their hands.
Okay, all of you who haven't got wands need to attach yourself to somebody who has. We'll need to be fast before they stop us. Come on.
They managed to cram themselves into 2 lifts. Harry's Patronus stood sentinel before the golden grills as they shut, and the lifts began to rise.
Level 8,
said the witch's cool voice.
Atrium.
Harry knew at once that they were in trouble. The atrium was full of people moving from fireplace to fireplace, sealing them off.
Harry!
Squeaked Hermione.
What are we going to...
Stop!
Harry thundered, and the powerful voice of Runcorn echoed through the atrium. The wizard sealing the fireplaces froze.
Follow me,
he whispered to the group of terrified muggle-borns, who moved forward in a huddle, shepherded by Ron and Hermione.
What's up, Albert?
Said the same balding wizard who had followed Harry out of the fireplace earlier. He looked nervous.
This lot need to leave before you seal the exit, said Harry, with all the authority he could muster.
The group of wizards in front of him looked at one another.
We've been told to seal all exits and not let anyone...
Are you contradicting me? Harry blustered. Would you like me to have your family tree examined, like I had Dirk Cresswell's?
Sorry,
gasped the balding wizard, backing away.
I didn't mean nothing, Albert, but I thought they were in for questioning and...
Their blood is pure,
said Harry, and his deep voice echoed impressively through the hall.
Purer than many of yours, I dare say. Off you go,
he boomed to the muggle-borns, who scurried forward into the fireplaces and began to vanish in pairs. The ministry wizards hung back, some looking confused, others scared and resentful. Then...
Mary!
Mrs. Cattermole looked over her shoulder. The real Reg Cattermole, no longer vomiting but pale and wan, had just come running out of a lift.
Reg?
She looked from her husband to Ron, who swore loudly. The balding wizard gaped, his head turning ludicrously from one Reg Cattermole to the other.
Hey! What's going on? What is this?
Seal the exit! Seal it!
Yaxley had burst out of another lift and was running toward the group beside the fireplaces, into which all of the muggle-borns but Mrs. Cattermole had now vanished. As the balding wizard lifted his wand, Harry raised an enormous fist and punched him, sending him flying through the air.
He's been helping muggle-borns escape, Yaxley! Harry shouted.
The balding wizard's colleagues set up an uproar, under cover of which Ron grabbed Mrs. Cattermole, pulled her into the still-open fireplace, and disappeared. Confused, Yaxley looked from Harry to the punched wizard, while the real Reg Cattermole screamed,
My wife! Who was that with my wife? What's going on?
Harry saw Yaxley's head turn, saw an inkling of the truth dawn in that brutish face.
Come on!
Harry shouted at Hermione. He seized her hand, and they jumped into the fireplace together, as Yaxley's curse sailed over Harry's head. They spun for a few seconds, before shooting up out of a toilet into a cubicle. Harry flung open the door. Ron was standing there beside the sinks, still wrestling with Mrs. Cattermole.
Reg, I don't understand.
Let go. I'm not your husband. You've got to go home.
There was a noise in the cubicle behind them. Harry looked around. Yaxley had just appeared.
Let's go!
Harry yelled. He seized Hermione by the hand and Ron by the arm and turned on the spot. Darkness engulfed them, along with the sensation of compressing bands, but something was wrong. Hermione's hand seemed to be sliding out of his grip. He wondered whether he was going to suffocate. He could not breathe or see. And the only solid things in the world were Ron's arm and Hermione's fingers, which were slowly slipping away. And then he saw the door of number 12 Grimmauld Place with its serpent door knocker. But before he could draw breath, there was a scream and a flash of purple light. Hermione's hand was suddenly vice-like upon his, and everything went dark again. Chapter 14. The Thief. Harry opened his eyes and was dazzled by gold and green. He had no idea what had happened. He only knew that he was lying on what seemed to be leaves and twigs. Struggling to draw breath into lungs that felt flattened, he blinked and realized that the gaudy glare was sunlight streaming through a canopy of leaves far above him. Then an object twitched close to his face. He pushed himself onto his hands and knees, ready to face some small, fierce creature, but saw that the object was Ron's foot. Looking around, Harry saw that they and Hermione were lying on a forest floor, apparently alone. Harry's first thought was of the Forbidden Forest, and for a moment, even though he knew how foolish and dangerous it would be for them to appear in the grounds of Hogwarts, his heart leapt at the thought of sneaking through the trees to Hagrid's hut. However, in the few moments it took for Ron to give a low groan and Harry to start crawling toward him, he realized that this was not the Forbidden Forest. The trees looked younger. They were more widely spaced, the ground clearer. He met Hermione, also on her hands and knees, at Ron's head. The moment his eyes fell upon Ron, all other concerns fled Harry's mind, for blood drenched the whole of Ron's left side, and his face stood out, greyish-white, against the leaf-strewn earth. The polyjuice potion was wearing off now. Ron was halfway between Cattermole and himself in appearance, his hair turning redder and redder as his face drained of the little colour it had left.
"What's happened to him?"
"Splinched," said Hermione, her fingers already busy at Ron's sleeve, where the blood was wettest and darkest. Harry watched, horrified, as she tore open Ron's shirt. He had always thought of splinching as something comical, but this... His insides crawled unpleasantly as Hermione laid bare Ron's upper arm, where a great chunk of flesh was missing, scooped cleanly away, as though by a knife.
"Harry, quickly, in my bag. There's a small bottle labelled Essence of Dittany."
"Bag. Right." Harry sped to the place where Hermione had landed, seized the tiny beaded bag, and thrust his hand inside it. At once, object after object began presenting itself to his touch. He felt the leather spines of books, woolly sleeves of jumpers, heels of shoes.
"Quickly!"
He grabbed his wand from the ground and pointed it into the depths of the magical bag.
"Hasio, Dittany!"
A small brown bottle zoomed out of the bag. He caught it and hastened back to Hermione, and Ron, whose eyes were now half closed, strips of white eyeball all that were visible between his lids.
"He's fainted,"
said Hermione, who was also rather pale. She no longer looked like Mafalda, though her hair was still grey in places.
"Unstopper it for me, Harry. My hands are shaking."
Harry wrenched the stopper off the little bottle. Hermione took it and poured 3 drops of the potion onto the bleeding wound. Greenish smoke billowed upward, and when it had cleared, Harry saw that the bleeding had stopped. The wound now looked several days old. New skin stretched over what had just been open flesh.
"Wow," said Harry. "It's all I feel safe doing," said Hermione shakily. "There are spells that would put him completely right, but I daren't try in case I do them wrong and cause more damage. He's lost so much blood already." "How did he get hurt? I mean..."
Harry shook his head, trying to clear it, to make sense of whatever had just taken place. "Why are we here? I thought we were going back to Grimald Place." Hermione took a deep breath. She looked close to tears.
"Harry, I don't think we're going to be able to go back there."
"What do you..."
"As we disapparated, Yaxley caught hold of me, and I couldn't get rid of him. He was too strong, and he was still holding on when we arrived at Grimald Place. And then, well, I think he must have seen the door, and thought we were stopping there, so he slackened his grip, and I managed to shake him off. And I brought us here instead."
"But then..."
"Where's he? Hang on. You don't mean he's at Grimald Place? He can't get in there."
Her eyes sparkled with unshed tears as she nodded.
"Harry, I think he can. I forced him to let go with a revulsion jinx, but I'd already taken him inside the Fidelius charm's protection. Since Dumbledore died, we're secret keepers. So I've given him the secret. Haven't I?"
There was no pretending. Harry was sure she was right. It was a serious blow. If Yaxley could now get inside the house, there was no way that they could return. Even now he could be bringing other Death Eaters in there by apparition. Gloomy and oppressive though the house was, it had been their one safe refuge, even, now that Creature was so much happier and friendlier, a kind of home. With a twinge of regret that had nothing to do with food, Harry imagined the house elf busying himself over the steak and kidney pie that Harry, Ron, and Hermione would never eat.
"Harry, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry."
"Don't be stupid. It wasn't your fault. If anything, it was mine."
Harry put his hand in his pocket and drew out Mad Eye's eye. Hermione recoiled, looking horrified. Umbridge had stuck it to her office door to spy on people. I couldn't leave it there, but that's how they knew there were intruders. Before Hermione could answer, Ron groaned and opened his eyes. He was still grey and his face glistened with sweat.
"How do you feel?"
Hermione whispered.
Lousy, croaked Ron, wincing as he felt his injured arm. Where are we?
In the woods where they held the Quidditch World Cup, said Hermione. I wanted somewhere enclosed undercover, and this was...
The first place you thought of, Harry finished for her, glancing around at the apparently deserted glade. He could not help remembering what had happened the last time they had apparated to the first place Hermione had thought of. How Death Eaters had found them within minutes. Had it been legilimency? Did Voldemort or his henchmen know even now where Hermione had taken them?
Do you reckon we should move on?
Ron asked Harry, and Harry could tell by the look on Ron's face that he was thinking the same.
I don't know.
Ron still looked pale and clammy. He had made no attempt to sit up, and it looked as though he was too weak to do so. The prospect of moving him was daunting. Let's stay here for now, Harry said. Looking relieved, Hermione sprang to her feet. Where are you going? Asked Ron.
If we're staying, we should put some protective enchantments around the place, she replied.
And, raising her wand, she began to walk in a wide circle around Harry and Ron, murmuring incantations as she went. Harry saw little disturbances in the surrounding air. It was as if Hermione had cast a heat haze upon their clearing.
Salvio Hexia! Protego Totalum! Repello Muggletum! Muffliato! You could get out the tent, Harry.
Tent?
In the bag.
In the...
Of course, said Harry.
He did not bother to grope inside it this time, but used another summoning charm. The tent emerged in a lumpy mass of canvas, rope, and poles. Harry recognized it, partly because of the smell of cats, as the same tent in which they had slept on the night of the Quidditch World Cup.
I thought this belonged to that bloke Perkins at the Ministry, he asked, starting to disentangle the tent pegs. Apparently he didn't want it back. His lumbago's so bad, said Hermione, now performing complicated figure-of-eight movements with her wand. So Ron's dad said I could borrow it. Erecto, she added, pointing her wand at the misshapen canvas, which, in one fluid motion, rose into the air and settled, fully constructed, onto the ground before Harry, out of whose startled hands a tent peg soared, to land with a final thud at the end of a guy rope.
Cave inimicum, Hermione finished with a skyward flourish.
That's as much as I can do. At the very least, we should know they're coming. I can't guarantee it will keep out Vol.
Don't say the name! Ron cut across her, his voice harsh. Harry and Hermione looked at each other.
I'm sorry, Ron said, moaning a little as he raised himself to look at them. But it feels like a jinx or something. Can't we call him You-Know-Who, please?
Dumbledore said fear of a name, began Harry.
In case you hadn't noticed, mate, calling You-Know-Who by his name didn't do Dumbledore much good in the end,
Ron snapped back.
Just show You-Know-Who some respect, will you?
Respect, Harry repeated, but Hermione shot him a warning look. Apparently he was not to argue with Ron while the latter was in such a weakened condition. Harry and Hermione half-carried, half-dragged Ron through the entrance of the tent. The interior was exactly as Harry remembered it, a small flat, complete with bathroom and tiny kitchen. He shoved aside an old armchair and lowered Ron carefully onto the lower berth of a bunk bed. Even this very short journey had turned Ron whiter still, and once they had settled him on the mattress, he closed his eyes again and did not speak for a while.
I'll make some tea, said Hermione breathlessly, pulling kettle and mugs from the depths of her bag and heading toward the kitchen.
Harry found the hot drink as welcome as the fire whiskey had been on the night that Mad-Eye had died. It seemed to burn away a little of the fear fluttering in his chest. After a minute or two, Ron broke the silence.
"What do you reckon happened to the catamoles?"
"With any luck, they'll have got away,"
said Hermione, clutching her hot mug for comfort.
"As long as Mr. Catamole had his wits about him, he'll have transported Mrs. Catamole by side-along apparition, and they'll be fleeing the country right now with their children. That's what Harry told her to do."
"Blimey, I hope they escaped,"
said Ron, leaning back on his pillows. The tea seemed to be doing him good. A little of his colour had returned.
"I didn't get the feeling Reg Catamole was all that quick-witted, though, the way everyone was talking to me when I was him. God, I hope they made it."
if they both end up in Azkaban because of us. Harry looked over at Hermione, and the question he had been about to ask, about whether Mrs. Cattermole's lack of a wand would prevent her apparating alongside her husband, died in his throat. Hermione was watching Ron fret over the fate of the Cattermoles, and there was such tenderness in her expression that Harry felt almost as if he had surprised her in the act of kissing him. "So, have you got it?" Harry asked her, partly to remind her that he was there.
"Got? Got what?" she said with a little start.
"What did we just go through all that for? The locket! Where's the locket?
You got it?"
shouted Ron, raising himself a little higher on his pillows. "No one sells me anything! Blimey, you could have mentioned it!"
"Well, we were running for our lives from the Death Eaters, weren't we?"
said Hermione.
"Here."
And she pulled the locket out of the pocket of her robes and handed it to Ron. It was as large as a chicken's egg. An ornate letter S, inlaid with many small green stones, glinted dully in the diffused light shining through the tent's canvas roof.
"There isn't any chance someone's destroyed it since Creature had it?"
asked Ron hopefully.
"I mean, are we sure it's still a Horcrux?"
"I think so," said Hermione, taking it back from him and looking at it closely.
"There'd be some sign of damage if it had been magically destroyed."
She passed it to Harry, who turned it over in his fingers. The thing looked perfect, pristine. He remembered the mangled remains of the diary, and how the stone in the Horcrux ring had been cracked open when Dumbledore destroyed it.
"I reckon Creature's right," said Harry. "We're going to have to work out how to open this thing before we can destroy it."
Sudden awareness of what he was holding, of what lived behind the little golden doors, hit Harry as he spoke. Even after all their efforts to find it, he felt a violent urge to fling the locket from him. Mastering himself again, he tried to prise the locket apart with his fingers, then attempted the charm Hermione had used to open Regulus's bedroom door. Neither worked. He handed the locket back to Ron and Hermione, each of whom did their best, but were no more successful at opening it than he had been.
"Can you feel it, though?"
Ron asked in a hushed voice as he held it tight in his clenched fist.
"What do you mean?"
Ron passed the Horcrux to Harry. After a moment or two, Harry thought he knew what Ron meant. Was it his own blood pulsing through his veins that he could feel? Or was it something beating inside the locket, like a tiny metal heart?
"What are we going to do with it?"
Hermione asked. "Keep it safe till we work out how to destroy it," Harry replied, and, little though he wanted to, he hung the chain around his own neck, dropping the locket out of sight beneath his robes, where it rested against his chest beside the pouch Hagrid had given him. "I think we should take it in turns to keep watch outside the tent," he added to Hermione, standing up and stretching. "And we'll need to think about some food as well.
You stay there,"
he added sharply as Ron attempted to sit up and turned a nasty shade of green. With the sneakoscope Hermione had given Harry for his birthday set carefully upon the table in the tent, Harry and Hermione spent the rest of the day sharing the role of lookout. However, the sneakoscope remained silent and still upon its point all day. And whether, because of the protective enchantments and muggle-repelling charms Hermione had spread around them, or because people rarely ventured this way, their patch of wood remained deserted, apart from occasional birds and squirrels. Evening brought no change. Harry lit his wand as he swapped places with Hermione at 10 o'clock, and looked out upon a deserted scene, noting the bats fluttering high above him across the single patch of starry sky visible from their protected clearing. He felt hungry now, and a little light-headed. Hermione had not packed any food in her magical bag as she had assumed that they would be returning to Grimald Place that night, so they had had nothing to eat except some wild mushrooms that Hermione had collected from amongst the nearest trees and stewed in a billy can. After a couple of mouthfuls, Ron had pushed his portion away, looking queasy. Harry had only persevered so as not to hurt Hermione's feelings. The surrounding silence was broken by odd rustlings and what sounded like crackings of twigs. Harry thought that they were caused by animals rather than people, yet he kept his wand held tight at the ready. His insides, already uncomfortable due to their inadequate helping of rubbery mushrooms, tingled with unease. He had thought that he would feel elated if they managed to steal back the Horcrux, but somehow he did not. All he felt as he sat looking out at the darkness, of which his wand lit only a tiny part, was worry about what would happen next. It was as though he had been hurtling toward this point for weeks, months, maybe even years, but now he had come to an abrupt halt, run out of road. There were other Horcruxes out there somewhere, but he did not have the faintest idea where they could be. He did not even know what all of them were. Meanwhile, he was at a loss to know how to destroy the only one that they had found, the Horcrux that currently lay against the bare flesh of his chest. Curiously, it had not taken heat from his body, but lay so cold against his skin it might just have emerged from icy water. From time to time, Harry thought, or perhaps imagined, that he could feel the tiny heartbeat ticking irregularly alongside his own. Nameless forebodings crept upon him as he sat there in the dark. He tried to resist them, push them away, yet they came at him relentlessly. Neither can live while the other survives. Ron and Hermione, now talking softly behind him in the tent, could walk away if they wanted to. He could not. And it seemed to Harry as he sat there, trying to master his own fear and exhaustion, that the Horcrux against his chest was ticking away the time he had left. "Stupid idea," he told himself. "Don't think that." His scar was starting to prickle again. He was afraid that he was making it happen by having these thoughts, and tried to direct them into another channel. He thought of poor creature, who had expected them home, and had received Yaxley instead. Would the elf keep silent, or would he tell the Death Eater everything he knew? Harry wanted to believe that creature had changed toward him in the past month, that he would be loyal now. But who knew what would happen? What if the Death Eaters tortured the elf? Sick images swarmed into Harry's head, and he tried to push these away too, for there was nothing he could do for creature. He and Hermione had already decided against trying to summon him. What if someone from the Ministry came too? They could not count on elfish apparition being free from the same flaw that had taken Yaxley to Grimald Place on the hem of Hermione's sleeve. Harry's scar was burning now. He thought that there was so much they did not know. Lupin had been right about magic they had never encountered or imagined. Why hadn't Dumbledore explained more? Had he thought that there would be time, that he would live for years, for centuries perhaps, like his friend Nicholas Flamel? If so, he had been wrong. Snape had seen to that. Snape, the sleeping snake who had struck at the top of the tower. And Dumbledore had fallen. Fallen.
"Give it to me, Gregorovitch!"
Harry's voice was high, clear and cold, his wand held in front of him by a long-fingered white hand. The man at whom he was pointing was suspended upside down in mid-air, though there were no ropes holding him. He swung there, invisibly and eerily bound, his limbs wrapped about him, his terrified face on a level with Harry's, ruddy due to the blood that had rushed to his head. He had pure white hair and a thick, bushy beard, a trussed-up Father Christmas.
"I have it not! I have it no more! It was many years ago, stolen from me!"
"Do not lie to Lord Voldemort, Gregorovitch. He knows. He always knows."
The hanging man's pupils were wide, dilated with fear, and they seemed to swell bigger and bigger until their blackness swallowed Harry whole. And now Harry was hurrying along a dark corridor, in stout little Grigorovitch's wake as he held a lantern aloft. Grigorovitch burst into the room at the end of the passage, and his lantern illuminated what looked like a workshop. Wood shavings and gold gleamed in the swinging pool of light, and there on the window ledge sat perched, like a giant bird, a young man with golden hair. In the split second that the lantern's light illuminated him, Harry saw the delight upon his handsome face. Then the intruder shot a stunning spell from his wand, and jumped neatly backward out of the window with a crow of laughter. And Harry was hurtling back out of those wide, tunnel-like pupils, and Grigorovitch's face was stricken with terror.
"Who was the thief, Gregorovitch?"
said the high, cold voice.
"I do not know. I never knew. A young man. No, please, please!"
A scream that went on, and then a burst of green light.
Harry!
He opened his eyes, panting, his forehead throbbing. He had passed out against the side of the tent, had slid sideways down the canvas,